Jimmy Lee Bayless hadn't shared that story with his boss, and he saw no reason to do so now.
What am I supposed to tell my old man? Drake McBride lamented.
Tell him to get you a lawyer.
Oh, that's real funny.
Jimmy Lee Bayless said, I'm not joking.
Drake McBride kicked at a rock.
It just ain't fair.
I told you this whole thing was a bad idea. I warned you, but you wouldn't listen, Jimmy Lee Bayless groused.
Is that right? Well, partner, I recall your squinty little eyes lighting up like the 4th of July when you heard how many jillions of dollars we can make off this operation.
Jimmy Lee Bayless leaned against the wet bumper of the truck and mulled the situation. Removing all of Red Diamond's pipes and equipment from Section 22 would take several days, and then the pit would have to be filled. There simply wasn't enough time. Reaching into the pockets of his pants, Jimmy Lee Bayless was dismayed to discover that he was out of Tums again.
Hey, we could always start another fire, Drake McBride suggested, to stall the game wardens.
Are you serious?
I'm talking about a big one this time, a real monster.
No.
A fire that would burn for weeks. We'll keep the flames a couple of hundred yards downwind from the drill site. Then sneak in Melton and the boys to clear out our gear and bury the pit. Presto, we're out of the woods. Drake McBride paused. How come you looking at me that way?
Because you just may be the biggest bonehead I ever met.
What?
You heard me. In his own mind, Jimmy Lee Bayless was no longer employed by Red Diamond Energy, and therefore he felt free to insult Drake McBride. Never again would he address this numbskull as sir. You want another wildfire, do it yourself, he hissed at his ex-boss. Red as a tomato, Drake McBride balled his fists and stepped toward Jimmy Lee Bayless, who rose up and prepared to refracture Drake McBride's ribs if necessary. The men stood inches apart, glowering at one another, when a blood-curdling yowl cut through the fog. It sounded almost human, a cry someone might make after falling into boiling water. Jimmy Lee Bayless felt the hair rise on the back of his neck. Drake McBride frantically reached into the bed of the pickup truck and grabbed the rifle, which he waggled recklessly at the curtain of haze. "Give me my gun," Jimmy Lee Bayless said.
"Back off." Drake McBride's eyes were gleaming. "That was a panther," he whispered hoarsely.
"Let's get out of here."
"No, it's our only chance."
"Don't make me hurt you," said Jimmy Lee Bayless.
"We can be free of this mess right now with one shot."
With the rifle thrust forward, Drake McBride began creeping down the dirt road in the direction of the scream. Jimmy Lee Bayless followed closely, planning to overpower his brainless ex-boss, snatch the gun, and flee the Black Vine Swamp forever. Surely an experienced oil man could find a decent job in Mexico.
"You see that?"
Drake McBride stiffened, slowing his pace.
"What?"
"Something moving up ahead of us, I swear."
Jimmy Lee Bayless said, "I can't see nothing." But Drake McBride was not imagining ghosts. The fog parted and a tawny shape materialized, sleek and low-slung. It was poised on muscled haunches barely 10 yards away, its pale gold eyes locked on the two startled men. The cat remained motionless except for a twitch of its long, kinked tail. Jimmy Lee Bayless held his breath. Never had he seen such an imperial predator up close, yet he was more amazed than afraid. The presence of the rare panther was so hypnotic that Jimmy Lee Bayless failed to notice Drake McBride raising the rifle. Instantly, a palmetto exploded next to the cat, which snarled and made two great soaring leaps into the mist. Half-crazed with fear and fury, Drake McBride fired two more rounds. Jimmy Lee Bayless lunged for the gun, but Drake McBride jerked away, aiming blindly into the shrouded trees. By the time Jimmy Lee Bayless was able to tackle him, Drake McBride had run out of bullets. A heavy electric silence settled upon the swamp.
Twisting the rifle from his ex-boss's hands, Jimmy Lee Bayless said, "I ought to leave you out here to rot."
"Did I hit the dang thing?"
Drake McBride asked. "You better hope not."
"What? You gonna turn me in?" "I don't think so,"
Drake McBride said with a smirk.
"Now stop all this nonsense and help me up, partner."
Both of them jumped at the sound of a metallic click, which was followed by a flat voice.
"Drop the weapon and stand slowly with your hands over your head. I won't say it twice."
Two men stepped out of the fog. One wore a coat and tie, and he was pointing a cocked revolver at Jimmy Lee Bayless. The other was dressed in a dark blue jumpsuit bearing the words, "Collier County Fire Department." With despair, Jimmy Lee Bayless recognized the second man immediately. It was Torkelson, the arson investigator. He said,
"Mr. Bayless, I would strongly advise you to do what Detective Marshall says."
Jimmy Lee Bayless obediently stood up, dropping the rifle as if it were a hot poker. As he raised his hands, he kicked Drake McBride in the butt and growled, "You happy now, bozo?" Drake McBride rose slowly, clutching his sides. If he'd been hoping for sympathy from the lawmen, he was disappointed.
"You're both under arrest," announced Detective Marshall.
"Hold on," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "I want to make a deal." Drake McBride glared at him.
"I don't believe this. You're going to try and hang it all on me?"
"With pleasure."
"Gentlemen, please," Torkelson interjected. "Give Detective Marshall your full attention."
"No, sir, no, sir,"
brayed Drake McBride, and he ran off crashing through the swamp. The arson investigator and the detectives traded shrugs, and they made no move to chase after the president of the Red Diamond Energy Corporation.
"Is he really that stupid?" Torkelson asked.
"Times 10, said Jimmy Lee Bayless, and held out his wrists for Jason Marshall to handcuff. 26. After the first gunshot, they dove to the ground and pressed themselves flat. Then came two other shots, followed shortly by more. Nick was sure he heard one of the bullets zing off a nearby tree. When the firing stopped, Twilly got up, pointing his own rifle. He was breathing hard, listening for human footfalls. Smoke was the next to stand. Then Nick and Marta, who was trembling badly. "Everybody okay?" Twilly asked. The kids nodded. But everybody was not okay. Mrs. Starch was still down. Her face was pale and her eyes looked glassy, and a crimson stain was blooming on the side of her canvas trousers.
"Oh, no," said Twilly.
He put down the rifle and knelt beside her. Nick and Smoke helped turn her over, while Marta stood back, sobbing softly. Twilly hurriedly cut away the bloody pants leg to examine the bullet wound, which was serious. Nick felt lightheaded and slightly sick. "She needs a doctor," he said. "Is she gonna die?" Marta called tearfully. Mrs. Starch lifted her head.
"No, dear, I am not going to die."
Her voice was weak but firm.
"We're taking you to the hospital," Twilly said.
There was no debate, no argument. Because Mrs. Starch was a large person, Twilly and Duane Scrod, Jr., the two strongest in the group, would attempt to carry her back to the car. It would be a long, difficult haul through the marsh and hammocks. Without asking, Twilly tore a strip of fabric from Smoke's shirt to make a pressure bandage.
"We don't have much time. You're bleeding like crazy."
"I'm aware of that," Mrs. Starch said. "Where's the kitten?"
At that very moment, something swift and heavy burst from a nearby thicket, a tan, snarling streak that passed within arm's reach of the fallen teacher and her helpers before bounding to the top of a craggy dead pine.
"It's her," Smoke said.
He gazed up with pure awe at the mother panther, which was panting hotly and still spooked from the gunfire.
"Where's the kitten?"
Mrs. Starch whispered again. Nick scanned the clearing and spotted the cub, a frightened lump huddled on a bed of pine straw.
"He's fine," Nick assured Mrs. Starch.
"Can you handle him? It's all up to you now," she said. "You and Marta.
We can do it."
With grim efficiency, Twilly worked on Mrs. Starch's leg to staunch the bleeding. Smoke kept his eyes glued on the panther in the tree, while Nick and Marta watched the kitten on the ground. The two cats, mother and baby, remained unaware of each other. After a few minutes, Twilly hoisted Mrs. Starch to her feet and instructed her how to hold on. Smoke got on the other side, and together he and Twilly formed a human crutch. "If you hear somebody coming," Twilly said to Nick and Marta, "take off running. If you can't get away, then use that." He nodded toward his rifle, leaning against a stump. Nick had never fired a real gun. His father didn't own one, though he'd become an expert marksman in the National Guard. Marta said, "I've shot a .22 before. My cousins in Miami took me to a target range." "This is different," Smoke told her. "Way different." With his free hand, Twilly pulled the vulture beak necklace from his pocket and tossed it to Marta. "You'll need all the mojo you can get," he said with a tight smile. Mrs. Starch was obviously in pain and fading. "Do your best," she told Nick and Marta, and then her eyelids began to flutter. Twilly pulled Nick aside and said, "I'll be back as soon as I can. Don't get yourself lost." "We'll be right here." Then without another word, Twilly and Smoke set off grimly across the foggy flatlands. Mrs. Starch was propped limply between them, her feet dragging, an arm around each of their shoulders. Smoke glanced back only once, with an anxious expression, and Nick waved. Marta put on Twilly's strange necklace and said, "You ready?" The fear was completely gone from her voice. "Let's do it," said Nick. The cub was still shaking from the noise of the gunfire when Nick scooped him up. There was no clawing or biting. Little Squirt seemed almost relieved to be held, even by an unknown human. With the kitten curled against his chest, Nick stood beneath the tall, dead pine, trying to visualize the climb. He wanted to put the cub as close as possible to the mother cat, who loomed only as a shadow, high in the gnarled boughs.
"What if it's the wrong panther?" Marta asked.
"No, Smoke said it's her."
"But what if he made a mistake?"
"He wouldn't," Nick said. And he didn't.
"That's a nasty old tree. Don't break your neck."
"Thanks for the pep talk." Nick began slowly, using only his right hand, to pull himself upward from one bare, brittle branch to the next. Hardly stirring, the kitten was nuzzled in the crook of his other arm. Purposely, Nick didn't look up at the powerful cat, who was watching every step of his ascent. But occasionally he glanced downward, where Marta stood guard at the base of the tree. Although it was weird seeing his young friend holding Twilly's rifle, Nick felt unaccountably secure. For no particular reason, he was confident that Marta would know how to handle the gun if necessary. And she did. He was halfway up the dead pine, at least 30 feet off the ground, when he heard her shout, "Stop, or I'll shoot! Stop right there!" Alarmed, Nick craned his neck to see what was happening below. As he shifted his weight, the branch beneath him snapped off, and he began dropping straight down, feet first, as if he were in a runaway elevator. It all happened in a dizzying wisp of a second. Nick's right sleeve snagged on something, another jagged branch, and he heard a sickening crack. A bolt of blinding pain shot from his wrist to the core of his brain. Then a wave of frozen blackness crashed over him. He experienced the sensation of twirling slowly in midair, like a circus acrobat. When he opened his eyes, he realized that he was dangling from a broken arm, and that very soon he would pass out. His chest was on fire from hot, stinging needles. It was the panther cub digging its claws into Nick's skin to hang on.
"He ran away! He's gone!"
Marta crowed triumphantly from beneath the tree.
"Who?"
Nick rasped. Some guy wrapped in bandages. I scared him off. Then she looked up into the tree and saw Nick swinging by his shirt sleeve. What in the world are you doing? What does it look like? He moaned. You're going to fall and kill yourself. A possibility had already occurred to Nick. Reaching up with his good arm, the left arm, the same arm he'd been training with and building up for weeks, he grabbed the branch from which he was dangling and began pulling himself up, pulling with all his strength, pulling in spite of the worst pain he'd ever felt or had ever imagined feeling, pulling even with a terrified wild panther cub attached like a cactus to his flesh, yowling and spitting in his face. Pulling and pulling until he'd completed your basic one-handed chin-up, no problem. Nick suspended himself in this grueling pose long enough to unsnag his sleeve with his teeth. His damaged arm flopped uselessly to his side. The elbow was bent at a very peculiar angle. An instant later, by some small miracle, his feet found a toehold for support. It was a deserted woodpecker nest, a baseball-sized hole in a weathered knob of the tree. Marta called, "I'm climbing up." "No," Nick said, because the mother panther was climbing down. Nick could see her silhouetted against the fog, moving closer. The animal easily weighed more than 100 pounds, yet she darted from limb to limb as if she were light as a sparrow. There was nothing for Nick to do but catch his breath and wait for the cub's cries to draw the big cat nearer. He supposed he should have been scared, but instead he felt oddly at ease. The panther was elegant and agile and ghostly, mesmerizing to watch. Although Nick had seen many panther photographs in books and magazines, he found himself in a state of dreamy amazement. The scorching pain in his fractured arm had all but disappeared, causing him to wonder if he was slipping into shock. Soon the mother cat was only a few yards away, coiled on a heavy Y-shaped branch directly above Nick's head. Her ears flattened, her nose quivered, and her bright eyes fixed with fierce intensity on the noisy bundle that had tacked itself to the front of Nick's shirt. He knew the panther must be wondering why there was only one cub crying, wondering what had happened to her other one. Nick heard the deep rolling prelude of a growl that couldn't possibly be coming from the pint-sized kitten, and he knew the time had come. Even with both shoes wedged in the woodpecker hole, he teetered and swayed as he struggled to unfasten the frightened baby from his chest. The little cat was now squalling loudly and with evident fright. Nick worried that the mother would soon pounce upon him in defense of her offspring. Marta must have had the same concern, for she'd braced herself against the tree to steady Twilly's rifle, which she was pointing squarely at the adult cat. Nick raised his eyes to the big panther and very gently said, "It's all right. I'm not going to hurt your little guy." The panther blinked and her ears perked. The cub let go of Nick's shirt, and ever so carefully, he placed it on the trunk of the tree. Its hooked claws dug into the crispy bark, and with a mighty yelp, the kitten attempted to climb. Immediately, the adult panther raised up, and a distinctly softer rumble came from her throat. Nick knew what had to be done now. As long as he remained in the tree, the mother cat would likely hold her distance from the baby. It was easy to envision the inexperienced kitten losing its grip and falling before it reached the Y-shaped branch. So Nick looked down and picked out a landing area. "Don't do it!" Marta shouted. "Stand clear," he said, and with his good strong left arm, he pushed himself away from the trunk of the tree. This time, luckily, he struck no branches on his way down. He landed on his back in a mound of pine straw. The last thing he saw before blacking out was the panther, outstretched in mid-leap, crossing to another tree. She was toting her cub by the scruff of its neck. Drake McBride tried to make up for all the rotten things he'd said about Horace.
"You're a good dog," he shouted down from the cypress tree.
But Horace didn't budge. Horace continued to bark and howl. Flecks of foamy spittle flew from the bloodhound's large jaws. Drake McBride was afraid to climb down because Horace looked positively crazed and ferocious. Nothing like the lazy mutt that the dog handler had brought to his hotel suite. Horace was totally wired. Horace wasn't budging from the base of the cypress tree up which he had chased the president of the Red Diamond Energy Corporation. It was the second jarring interruption of Drake McBride's escape. The first had occurred when he'd stumbled into a clearing and come face to face with a skinny Cuban girl holding a seriously large rifle. She had vowed to shoot if he took another step, and she'd seemed serious about it. So he had turned and fled, and kept on running until the bloodhound caught his scent and treed him like a dumb possum.
"Good boy,"
hollered Drake McBride for the 18th time.
"Oh,"
replied Horace. This went on for 2 hours until suddenly the dog wheeled around, fell silent, and began wagging his tail. Momentarily, Horace was joined at the foot of the tree by a shirtless man wearing a knit ski beanie, wraparound shades, and an ammunition belt. Drake McBride figured the man was a poacher, not that he cared.
"Help me, bro," he begged.
"Come on down from there," the stranger said.
"What about the dog?"
"Hurry up, I don't have all day." Timidly, Drake McBride made his way to the ground. He was relieved to see that the bloodhound was now preoccupied with a bag of hamburgers.
"I can't believe I paid $5,000 for that wacko dog," Drake McBride said to the stranger. "Because they said he got eaten by a panther. I wish he had."
"You want him back?"
"After he chased me up a tree? I don't think so."
The man seemed amused.
"I guess Horace got bored and chewed through his rope."
Drake McBride was rattled.
"How do you know his name?"
"Horace and I go way back. Who are you?"
"I'm Drake W. McBride."
"Well, how about that for luck?" Drake McBride stuck out his right hand. The stranger didn't shake it, though he was smiling broadly.
"You know who I am?"
Drake McBride asked with surprise and a creeping sense of dread. The man said, "Yep."
"You're the boss of the Two-Bit Oil Company that's drilling an illegal well in this state wildlife preserve. Or should I say, was drilling?"
Drake McBride dejectedly wondered how much worse his day could possibly get.
"And who are you?" he asked in a hollow voice.
"I'm the one who called the Fish and Wildlife agents about the panther and glued your man Melton to a tree and sprayed him orange and gutted his truck and ripped off that load of pipes. I'm the one who's going to shut you down." The stranger took out a cell phone and dialed a number.
"The fog's lifting. Get the chopper up and come out here right away," he instructed someone on the other end.
Drake McBride considered making a dash for freedom, but knew he would only get himself more lost than he already was. Besides, it would be easy for the athletic-looking stranger to outrun a chunky, out-of-shape guy with fractured ribs.
"I'll give you $5,000 to forget about all this and let me go,"
Drake McBride said. The stranger laughed so sharply that Horace looked up for the mulch remains of his quarter-pounders.
"You remind me of my old man," the man said to Drake McBride. "That doesn't sound like a compliment."
"It's not."
"Then how about $10,000?
The stranger grew serious and swatted a fly on his neck. "Mr. McBride, I'll let you go for free," he said. "But there's not enough money in the world to make me forget what you did here."
$20,000, if I can hitch a ride back to town on your helicopter. 20,000 cash.
Sorry, man. The chopper's full.
Now wait.
Come on, Horace. The stranger jogged off into the black vine swamp, the bloodhound loping at his heels.
Hey, where you going?
Drake McBride shouted after him.
What about me? How do I get out of here?
Epilogue. More than a month after Mrs. Starch vanished, her third-period biology students filed anxiously into the classroom. Their expressions reflected a mix of excitement and uncertainty, for it was rumored that the most feared and surely most famous teacher at the Truman School would be returning for the first time since the fire at the Black Vine Swamp. By now all the kids knew what had happened. Nick and Marta had told the Panther story about 100 times. Nick's account of his daring climb to meet the big cat ended with him jumping from the tree and passing out. He also vaguely recalled waking up in a helicopter and seeing a hound dog, of all things, drooling on his shoes. Marta's necklace of vulture beaks was a big hit at school. Her version of the panther adventure recounted how she'd stood guard with a high-powered rifle, warding off a crazed intruder, while Nick was high in the branches reuniting the cub with its mother. She also provided vivid details of the helicopter rescue, including a hairy landing on the hospital's roof. It was a good story, no matter who told it. When the school bell rang, Dr. Dressler walked into the classroom. He looked more crisp and unflappable than usual, with good reason. The Board of Trustees had just given him a new 5-year contract to remain as headmaster of Truman. They had sweetened the deal with a generous raise based on a wave of positive publicity that the school had recently received. Bunny Starch and 3 of her students had saved the life of a rare panther cub, and in the process had helped expose a crooked oil drilling operation in the Big Cypress Preserve. It was huge news all over Florida, and was even featured by Anderson Cooper on CNN. As a result, the Truman School was being flooded with enrollment applications and, more importantly, donation checks. While Dr. Dressler had nothing to do with the heroics of Mrs. Starch and her pupils, he was pleased to bask at the edge of the limelight.
"I have 2 brief announcements," he said to the biology class. "First, the suspension of Duane Scrod, Jr. is hereby suspended. I'm proud and delighted to welcome him back to Truman."
The headmaster turned toward the open door and motioned with 2 fingers. As soon as smoke entered the room, everybody began to applaud except Nick, whose right arm was still encased in plaster from his fingers to his shoulder. Instead of clapping, Nick slapped the palm of his left hand against the top of his desk. Smoke seemed mortified at the attention, and he hustled to seat himself as fast as possible. Marta passed a note to Nick.
"He looks thinner."
Nick noticed it, too. Smoke had spent the past 14 days in the county juvenile hall, which was not famous for serving hearty and nutritious meals. His classmates had been outraged that Smoke was locked up after all the good he'd done. Without his keen tracking skills, the missing mother panther might not have been found. And without his muscles, Mrs. Starch might never have made it alive to the emergency room after being shot. Although the arson case against Smoke was dropped, a Texas oil man named Jimmy Lee Bayless confessed to the crime. The state prosecutor had insisted on punishing the boy for fleeing from the police. At the time, Smoke had been on probation for the 2 arsons he'd committed when he was younger. Even Jason Marshall thought 2 weeks behind bars was too harsh, considering the circumstances. Libby had persuaded her father to make a call on Duane Jr.'s behalf, but the prosecutor wouldn't budge. So Smoke had served his time without complaint, a model inmate.
"My second announcement deals with another rumor flying around campus," Dr. Dressler said. "This one happens to be true. Today there will be no substitute biology teacher. Mrs. Starch, do you need some assistance?"
A familiar icy voice from the hallway
I certainly do not.
She clomped briskly and with purpose into the classroom. The crutches didn't make her look frail and wobbly. In fact, she seemed taller and more imposing than ever. Her bleached hair was piled into an exceptionally steep slope, and the violet shadow on her eyelids appeared to have been applied with an industrial paint roller. The anvil-shaped scar on her chin showed up like a fresh bruise against the hospital paleness of her skin. Yet the students responded to her arrival in a spontaneous and unexpected way. They all rose from their desks, cheering and whistling and clapping. Dr. Dressler, to his own mild surprise, joined in. For once, Mrs. Starch was speechless. She crutched to her desk and fiercely began organizing her teaching materials. It looked to Nick as if she was trying not to cry. Eventually, the student settled down and Dr. Dressler smoothly excused himself. After an awkward silence, Mrs. Starch cleared her throat and said, "Good morning, people. Please open your books. We have lots of catching up to do." Graham Carson's arm shot up. Naturally, Mrs. Starch ignored him. Nick smiled and thought, "Some things never change."
"Who's prepared to tell me about Watson and Crick's model for DNA structure?"
Mrs. Starch asked. The usual squirming silence followed.
"Anybody bother to read Chapter 11, she said. "If you're having trouble finding it, try looking between Chapter 10 and Chapter 12.
Graham alone waved his hand. Mrs. Starch pivoted toward Mickey Maris and said, "Well?" Mickey Maris swallowed and began pawing frantically through his textbook.
"Watson's crickets?" he asked.
"It's Watson and Crick," Mrs. Starch said testily.
"Please," Graham Carson beseeched from across the room. "Please, Mrs. Starch."
She turned back and sighed in surrender.
"All right, Graham. Let's get this over with."
He popped to his feet and composed himself.
"Watson and Crick were two scientists who came up with a model of DNA called the double helix. It shows two strands of nucleotides twisting around each other. The outside of the helix is made up of sugar phosphates, and the inside is nitrogen bases."
The other student sat stunned and gaping. Mrs. Starch herself rocked back slightly on her crutches.
"Well done, Graham," she managed to say. "This is an historic day."
Nick snuck a peek at Marta, who didn't appear even slightly nauseated, as she often was in Mrs. Starch's class. Marta smiled back and whispered,
"I memorized the whole chapter, too."
Having recovered from the shock of Graham's correct answer, Mrs. Starch told him he could sit down.
"But I've got a question, a really important one," Graham said.
"It had better be.
How are you?"
"What?"
"I mean, are you going to be okay?" Graham asked. "Everybody's been worried."
Mrs. Starch seemed overwhelmed. Her eyes flickered first to Nick and Marta, and then over to Duane Scrod, Jr. After a moment of fluster, she said,
"Thank you for your concern, Graham. I'm going to be fine."
She plucked a yellow Ticonderoga No. 2 pencil from the cup on her desk and tapped the eraser against her left hip. "The bullet entered right here, below the joint," she said, "and passed all the way through my leg. Luckily, it missed the femoral artery, though barely." With a skeptical eye, she scanned the rapt faces of her students. "I don't suppose anybody besides Libby Marshall can describe the role of the femoral artery in the human circulatory system?" Libby's cheeks flushed. Mrs. Starch said,
"Relax, young lady. There's no shame in being smart."
Because of her injury, Mrs. Starch didn't cover as much territory as when she paced before. However, as always, she stayed in motion. "Before we discuss the features of the double helix," she said, moving down the center aisle, "I have one small piece of unfinished business."
She stopped at Smoke's desk and handed some papers to him. He examined them closely, his brow knitted. "That's your acne essay," Mrs. Start said.
"Right."
He brushed a shock of black hair away from his forehead. She said,
"The title is quite clever. The Curse of the Persistent Pimple. A nice touch of alliteration."
"Thanks," Smoke murmured wearily. "I knew you had a sense of humor, Duane. Didn't I tell the whole class? A wicked sense of humor?" He looked up at her. "But it says here I got an A-. Mrs. Starch nodded.
"Correct. If you hadn't misspelled endocrine, I would have given you an A."
Marta whistled under her breath. Mrs. Starch was notoriously stingy with A's. Smoke said,
"But Dr. Waxmoe gave me a D+.
"That's because Dr. Waxmoe is hopeless," said Mrs. Starch. "A dim bulb, if I may be so frank." The cruel red slashes from Wendell Waxmoe's pen were as vivid as ketchup stains all over Smoke's essay. So, too, was the supersized A- that Mrs. Starch had scrawled on the top page to block out the substitute teacher's grade.
"I never got an A before," Smoke said. "This isn't some kind of joke, is it?"
Nick hoped it wasn't. He hoped Mrs. Starch wasn't messing with the kid, not after he'd helped Twilly lug her out of the boonies and rush her to a hospital so she wouldn't bleed to death. Balancing on her crutches, Mrs. Starch said, "Duane, I don't joke about academic matters. Not ever."
"Do I still have to read it aloud?"
"Not unless you want to."
"Nope,"
Smoke said. "You wrote a solid, well-researched paper. I learned a few things about pimples that I never knew before." Mrs. Starch reached over and waggled the tip of her yellow Ticonderoga at the A- she'd marked on the essay. "You earned this," she told Duane Scrod, Jr.
"I guess," he said.
Then he casually chomped the pencil in half, chewed up the splinters along with the graphite, and downed the entire mouthful with a crunchy gulp. The classroom fell quiet as a tomb. Nobody could believe what they'd just seen. Nick was vaguely aware that his own jaw was hanging open. From the corner of one eye, he noticed Marta clutching her head in gloom. Mrs. Starch narrowed her eyes and ominously studied the moist stump of wood in her fingers. Then slowly she broke into a rare grin.
"You got me that time, Duane."
"Totally," he said, returning the smile. That same morning, Jimmy Lee Bayless posted bail at the Collier County Jail. Female guard named Waters escorted him from his cell to the front desk to collect his belongings. "Did he turn up yet?" Jimmy Lee Bayless asked. He was referring to his ex-boss, Drake McBride, who'd been missing in the Big Cypress since the day he'd run off into the fog. In the meantime, to avoid a long prison hitch, Jimmy Lee Bayless had agreed to plead guilty to setting the illegal fire in the Black Vine Swamp. He'd also promised to testify against Drake McBride, who faced a pile of serious charges, including the attempted killing of an endangered Florida panther.
"Funny you should ask,"
Officer Waters said to Jimmy Lee Bayless. "Mr. McBride turned up yesterday at a fancy hotel in Miami Beach. He'd grown a goatee and shaved his head and was using a fake name." Jimmy Lee Bayless was astonished that the moron even made it out of the wilderness, considering his lack of survival skills and lame sense of direction. The jail guard said Drake McBride had lost 22 pounds while hiking in circles through the Black Vine Swamp. Eventually, he'd stumbled out on Route 29, where a sympathetic trucker had picked him up. "They busted him while he was getting a massage," Officer Waters said.
"How'd they know where he was hiding out?" Jimmy Lee Bayless asked.
"His own father turned him in."
"Beautiful."
Apparently, Mr. McBride had called up begging for money. His dad got so ticked off that he phoned the police and gave them the address of the hotel, The room number two?
Jimmy Lee Bayless said, couldn't happen to a sweeter guy. Is my lawyer here?
He's waiting outside, said Officer Waters.
She handed Jimmy Lee Bayless a paper bag containing his wristwatch, wallet, cell phone, and a crumpled empty wrapper for Tum's stomach tablets. He thanked her and proceeded to the mesh steel door that led to the outside world. The guard said, before you go, Mr. Bayless, there's something else you should know. My son was one of the students in the swamp that day you started the fire. He was also out there when your pal went ballistic with that rifle. Jimmy Lee Bayless realized he was a captive audience. Literally. Officer Waters held the keys to the jail door, and she seemed in no rush to open it.
I'm real sorry, ma'am. I hope your boy wasn't hurt, he said.
Please believe me. Drake McBride was never my pal. Man up, Mr. Bayless. You guys were in on the oil scam together. Everything that happened out there was your fault as much as his. She was right. And Jimmy Lee Bayless didn't have the nerve to argue. I'm going to try to make up for it, he said dismally.
You were greedy.
Yes, ma'am, that's true enough.
And reckless, she added.
I know. Jimmy Lee Bayless gazed longingly at the locked exit door. Officer Waters stepped closer and poked him in the chest.
My son fractured his arm out there, she said.
Jeez. Only different ways can I say I'm sorry.
Jimmy Lee Bayless felt nervous and trapped. Up until now, the female guard had always treated him decently.
She said, when you go to court, Mr. Bayless, you'd better get up on that witness stand and give the truth. That means telling the judge everything you did and everything you know.
Sure, of course.
You made a deal.
Keep it.
I aim to, Jimmy Lee Bayless insisted. And don't get any clever ideas. Officer Waters produced a stack of glossy travel brochures from Mexico. Jimmy Lee Bayless paled.
I found these under the mattress in your cell, she said.
Jimmy Lee Bayless managed a shrug. A man can dream, can he? Not when a judge is holding his passport, he can't. Goodbye, Mr. Bayless.
Nick Waters' mother unlocked the heavy steel door, and Jimmy Lee Bayless walked out of jail with no bounce in his step. The lawyer, whom he'd met only over the phone, was waiting in the lobby. He wore a black double-breasted suit and carried a briefcase made from a dead crocodile. His name was Bernard Beanstoop III.
But everyone called me Bernie the Bean, he said brightly.
Jimmy Lee Bayless shook the lawyer's hand and said, pleasure to meet you, Bernie. But he didn't really mean it. Millicent Winship banged on the screen door with as much force as she could summon from her 77-year-old, 92-pound body. She was determined to be heard over the Mahler symphony that was blaring from her son-in-law's house. Finally, she stalked down the steps and picked up a rusty crowbar that was lying in the cluttered yard. Her chauffeur knew better than to interfere as Mrs. Winship calmly walked up to a window and shattered it with one swing. The music stopped immediately, and Duane Scrod, Sr. appeared on the porch, the macaw screeching hysterically on his shoulder.
"Millie, you're out of your mind!" he yelled.
"Kindly tell your parrot to hush up!
Don't you touch Nadine!"
"Eep!"
cried the bird.
"Au secours! Help her!"
A brown, floppy-eared head poked sleepily out of the frame of the broken window, startling Mrs. Winship.
"Somebody gave Junior a bloodhound," Duane Scrod, Sr. explained unhappily. "His name is Horace."
Mrs. Winship set the crowbar down against the house. She said,
"We had a luncheon engagement at noon sharp. It's now 1:30.
Duane Scrod, Sr. slapped himself on the side of the head and said,
"Damn!"
Mrs. Winship stroked the hound dog's furrowed forehead.
"You know how I feel about rudeness, Duane?"
"I got mixed up. I thought our lunch was tomorrow."
"You also know how I feel about carelessness."
"Sorry, Millie."
The macaw squawked and flared its wings as if it were about to make a dive at Mrs. Winship. She glowered at the bird and said,
Don't even think about it, Nadine.
Duane Scrott Sr. hustled his noisy pet into its cage. Then he threw on a clean shirt and ran a comb through his hair. Mrs. Winship had made reservations at a restaurant near the Naples Pier. She chose a table on the patio where they could see the gulls and listen to the waves on the beach. Duane Scrott Sr. was too nervous to enjoy the sunny setting.
"I'll pay you back," he blurted at his mother-in-law. "For what?"
"Hiring that lawyer for Junior. I know he didn't come cheap." Mrs. Winship shook her head and speared a shrimp from her salad.
"The man thinks he's Perry Mason. But he sure lost interest in DJ once the arson charges were dropped. 2 whole weeks in juvenile detention. Let's just say Mr. Beanstoop and I have negotiated a steep reduction in his fee."
"Who's Perry Mason?" Duane Sr. asked.
"Oh, never mind.
I still want to pay you back.
You take care of the broken window and we'll call it even. But I've got a job now, Billy. I'll have money coming in."
Her fork halted in midair, carrying another impaled shrimp.
"What kind of job?" she asked.
"Piano teacher. I already have 3 kids signed up for weekly lessons." Mrs. Winship smiled.
"That's excellent. I won't get rich," Duane Scrod Sr. said. "But it's good work. I'm liking it."
"You've always had talent. That wasn't the problem." "Guess what else? I got my wheels again. Smithers Chevrolet put a new transmission in the Tahoe. They finally gave up, Millie. I won."
"Congratulations,"
Mrs. Winship said. "They're going to repaint it, too."
"As they should."
Mrs. Winship didn't mention her recent phone conversation with Randolph Smithers. As she'd suspected, the car dealer had seen the newspaper stories and TV reports about the Panther rescue, and he was aware of the important role played by young Duane Scrod Jr. Mrs. Winship had told Randolph Smithers that her grandson hadn't yet given any press interviews, but that if he did, he would certainly be asked about his father. The father who had no car, no life, no future, all because the vehicle he'd purchased in good faith from Smithers Chevrolet had blown a transmission. Randolph Smithers had quickly agreed with Mrs. Winship that it was time to let bygones be bygones, even though Duane Scrod Sr. had burned down the dealership. Smithers said he'd repair the Tahoe on the condition that the Scrods would speak only kindly of his auto business, or better yet, would not mention it at all. "Junior went back to school today," Duane Sr. said, finally taking a chomp of his fried grouper sandwich.
"How's his attitude?" Mrs. Winship asked.
"Anything beats sitting in jail. I bought him a new book bag."
"I'm impressed, Duane. Seriously.
And a waterproof tent for his camping trips. I intend to do better by that boy, Millie, I swear." Mrs. Winship said,
"He doesn't need more stuff. He needs a father."
"You're right. That's what I meant.
Duane, do you really want to pay me back and be a dad to your son?"
Mrs. Winship daintily devoured the last pink shrimp on her plate. She knew what the next topic of conversation would be.
"How's Whitney?" asked Duane Scrod Sr. "Not happy. The health department shut down her shop after some government minister got sick from spoiled brie that he'd bought there."
"She got busted by the health department in Paris?"
"The French take their cheeses very seriously," Mrs. Winship explained.
"So, does that mean Whitney's coming home?"
"No, Duane, she's not."
"Good," he said.
"In fact, she's filing for divorce."
"That's okay with me." Mrs. Winship blinked. She wasn't sure she'd heard him correctly. Duane Sr. said, "There's a lady I intend to ask out on a date. She plays folk guitar at the Unitarian Church."
"A haircut and a shave wouldn't hurt your chances,"
Mrs. Winship suggested.
DJ said the same thing. You might want to clean up the house, too, in case your guitarist also works for the health department.
Don't worry, said Duane Scrodd Sr. sheepishly. And you must definitely get rid of that awful parrot.
Millie, she's not a parrot.
Mrs. Winship said, just think about it, please. In all the media accounts of the Panther episode, there was no mention of Twilly's spree, which is how he wanted it. Mrs. Starch and the kids had agreed to leave him out of the story, although his role was not small. After driving Mrs. Starch to the hospital and leaving Duane Scrodd Jr. to stay with her, Twilly had rushed back to get the two other kids. Sprinting through the black vine swamp, he'd encountered first Horace and then Drake McBride, only one of whom would fit in the helicopter along with Nick and Marta. The dog was the obvious choice. By the time Twilly reached Nick and Marta, the fog had burned away and the woods were bathed in soft sunlight. The boy's right arm was badly broken and he'd passed out from the pain. The girl hovered beside him protectively, the rifle poised and ready. Twilly had no reason to tell her that he'd removed all the bullets before he left. Using a crude splint made from a branch, he had stabilized Nick's injured arm. Then, with Marta's help, he'd hoisted the boy on his shoulders and carefully made his way toward the clearing where the chopper would land. It was there that Twilly had spotted the panther trotting 100 yards ahead of them, carrying her cub toward a thicket of palmettos. Before vanishing, the cat had looked back just once. "Keep on moving, Mama," Twilly had urged under his breath. After the helicopter had landed, Twilly had strapped Nick inside and told Marta to keep an eye on him. He had no intention of riding back to Naples with them. The authorities would have more questions than he cared to answer. His pilot had been briefed on what to say, that he'd been flying from Miami to Fort Myers when he'd spotted the two kids lost in the glades. As for Horace the Bloodhound, Twilly had instructed Marta to give him to Duane Scrodd Jr., who was already at the hospital with Bunny Starch. Since dogs weren't allowed in the emergency room, Twilly had told Marta to tie Horace to the nearest tree and give him some water. After the chopper had buzzed away, Twilly had returned to camp and quickly packed his gear. He knew the swamp would be bustling in the coming days. News reporters, wildlife officers, and of course the work crews removing Red Diamond's outlaw drilling equipment. So Twilly Spree had trekked south through the Big Cypress, crossing Alligator Alley in the black of night, and a few days later, the Tamiami Trail. Zigzagging to avoid several small wildfires, Twilly had plenty of time to think about Drake McBride, whose fate he'd left to chance. There was a time when Twilly would have dealt more harshly with such a brainless greed head, inflicting some sort of poetic public humiliation. Instead, he just walked away and left the man hollering in the wilderness, unharmed and unshamed. Twilly wondered whether he was going soft or wising up. He also found himself thinking fondly of Duane Jr., Marta, and Nick, who had risked their necks for that little panther cub. The kids were tough and brave and determined to do the right thing, qualities that were often lacking among the grown-ups, Twilly knew. Aunt Bunny Starch was right, he'd mused. Hope springs eternal. Eventually, he hooked up with the Turner River and followed it all the way to the mouth of Chokoloskee Bay, where a small blue canoe had been stashed for him in the mangroves. Twilly stocked up on food and water at Everglades City, and he also stopped at the post office to mail something to Nick. Then he loaded the canoe and began paddling through the 10,000 islands with no particular destination. It was an easy place to get lost, which was precisely what he had in mind. 3 weeks after returning from the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, Nick's father announced they were going fishing. They rode to Chokoloskee through heavy fog, which reminded Nick of the day he'd come face to face with the mother panther. The fog made him think about Twilly, too. The man had dropped completely out of sight. A few days earlier, a plain brown package addressed to Nick had arrived by mail. Inside the package was a book, Hey Duke Lives,
by Edward Abbey. An unsigned note said, "From your favorite monkey wrencher, we'll meet again." Nick thought it was one of the coolest presents he'd ever received. The fishing guide, tanned and bearded, was waiting for the Waters family at the marina. The fog was dissolving and revealed a clear and cloudless morning. Nick and his parents got into the boat and smeared sunblock on their faces. The guide headed straight for Chatham Bend, zipping across miles of glassy shallows strewn with tree snags and stumps. He said the tide was perfect for snook and redfish. When they got there, Captain Gregory Waters moved to the bow, uneasily contemplating his fly rod. Nick said, "Go for it, Lefty." Most fly rods are designed to be held and cast with one hand, while the other hand is used to strip in the line. That's what makes the fly scoot like a minnow through the water and attracts big fish. Surgeons at Walter Reed had fitted Nick's father with an artificial right arm equipped with an actual bionic hand. The hand, called an I-limb, contained a computer chip that transmitted impulses from the nerves in Greg Waters' damaged shoulder. Amazingly, all five fingers of the bionic hand were able to move almost as nimbly as real ones. Nick's father had been practicing left-handed casts every afternoon at a pond near the Truman soccer field. He could now shoot a fly 70 feet through the air, true as a bullet. Stripping back the slick plastic line is what gave him fits. The artificial hand was protected by a special glove made of silicone, which got slippery. In addition, the mechanical fingers weren't quite coordinated enough to keep a firm grip. "This could get ugly," Nick's father muttered after a few exasperating tries on the skiff. "Oh, be quiet and catch us a fish," Nick's mother said. Nick didn't care if they caught anything or not. He was perfectly happy watching his father sweep the slender rod back and forth, the line carving graceful loops in the pale sky. The snook fly, a white, sparkled streamer, would settle so lightly in the water that it scarcely caused a ripple. Nick's father had several hard strikes, but he couldn't set the hook in time. The reflexes of his artificial hand were too slow. Still, it was much better than having no hand at all. There would be frustrating times, Nick knew, but in the end his dad was going to be fine. Only the day before they'd staged a backyard pitching contest. Nick's mom, who'd borrowed a radar gun from a friend on the Naples police force, clocked one of Greg Waters' fastballs at 81 miles an hour. Not too shabby for a rookie southpaw. Nick's fastest lefty pitch was only 59, and he'd almost beamed a neighbor Siamese cat. "Your turn, Nicky. I need a coffee break." His father stepped off the bow and passed him the fly rod. Nick tried over and over to make a decent cast, but his timing was all messed up. The bulky plaster mold on his right arm didn't help. The clockwork motion of stripping the line was virtually impossible if you couldn't bend your elbow. More often than not, Nick wound up thrashing in a comic tangle of knots. And after 20 minutes, he good-naturedly surrendered the fly rod. Throwing a baseball, he declared, was 1,000 times easier. Naturally, his mother caught the first and only fish of the morning. It was a husky 10-pound snook that jumped 6 times before the guide netted it. Said Nick's dad, "We'll never hear the end of this." By noon, a westerly wind had kicked up, so the guide moved the boat to Pavilion Key, staking out on the leeward side. For lunch, Nick's mom had fixed smoked turkey sandwiches and an avocado salad, which Captain Gregory Waters pronounced the best meal he'd ever eaten. When Nick asked what sort of food he got on combat duty, he laughed and said, "It didn't matter. Everything tasted like sand." The island was spangled with birds, herons, egrets, cormorants, terns, gulls, and even a cluster of white pelicans. The fishing guide said that only a week earlier, he'd seen a big bobcat swimming across the shallows. Intently, Nick scanned the shoreline. "Are there any panthers out here?" The guide shook his head. "They mostly stay up in the big cypress and the Fakahatchee." "You ever seen one?" Nick's father asked. "No, sir. And I was born and raised here.
Never laid eyes on one in 54 years.
Nick has, said his mother. A mother and her kitten.
The guide was impressed. There ain't hardly any of them left to see, he said.
It was on the news, Nick's mother said proudly.
Once she'd learned what he'd done that day high in the dead pine, she had immediately forgiven him for skipping school.
I'm afraid I don't watch much TV, the guide remarked.
Nick's dad chuckled. You're not missing a darn thing.
Can I ask what happened to your arm?
I was in a wreck, Captain Gregory Waters said simply.
My oldest, he's over there now. I wish he wasn't.
The guide took a bite of his sandwich and looked at Nick.
What about you?
I fell out of a tree. No big deal.
I'll bet it was.
You're right, said Dick's mother. It was a very big deal. Another skiff came speeding past, closer to the island. The seabirds exploded from the shore, filling the air like a starburst. Nick spotted something blue way up on the beach, and the guide said it appeared to be a small canoe. Then he said lunch was over and it was time to go fishing again. He said the two lefties had better get with the program.
This is Edward Asner. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Scat by Carl Hiaasen.
This program was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Jessica Kay.
Text copyright 2009 by Carl Hiaasen. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.